This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Please welcome Hal and Colin.
Let me know if you can't hear us. We will shout. Thanks, Sina, for hosting, Colin for reading, and all of you for coming. I mean, it's an awful night. Let me say a few things about this book, why I hope some of you might be interested in it. I mean, I know he's Sarah's a canonical figure who might seem beside the point now, but maybe I can convince you otherwise. You know, as Sina said, I met Sarah a long time ago in the early 1980s. This was soon after Tilda Dark was installed in the Federal Plaza in Lower Manhattan, and I assume most of you know a bit about the story there. It will come up eventually. Mm-hmm. These are just the images from the book. So Tilda Dark was installed. It was a commission by the government in 1981. And for a few years, there was little controversy. And then in the second administration of Ronald Reagan, the culture wars really began with great force. And it's my belief that the sculpture was taken up as an object lesson. And I think the attack on Tilda Dark was programmatic. Because, again, this was a government commission that the government then destroyed. There was a judge in the building at the courthouse where the sculpture was installed who initiated the campaign. And there were hearings, but the hearings seemed staged in a way. I testified on behalf of Sarah, not with the passion that he required, and so our friendship cooled for a time. In any case, by 1989, the government took the sculpture down, and this led Sarah to one negative definition of site-specific art, which is to move the sculpture is to destroy it. We can talk about the idea of site. We talk about it quite a bit in the book. We disagree about the genealogy of what a site is, how it differs from context. It's one of the through lines in our discussions. But this was obviously a critical moment for Sarah. He was an object of much abuse. I mean, he was a famous artist. He was just in his 40s still at the time. But he was really under attack. And I think it changed him, as you might imagine. In any case, we dropped out of touch for a few years. But by the early 1990s, he'd begun to develop his language anew. I mean, Tilda Dark is an arc, but it was a simple geometric form. In the early 1990s, he began to torque his sculptures. And he developed first torqued ellipses and then torqued spirals. Before, he did ribbon pieces, and you'll see a few that, as the slides go by, and this is on a loop, so you'll see these again. And this is an extraordinary development because it brought a public back to his work in ways that I don't think anyone expected. And it was a very rare instance of a real innovation in an art that was embraced as a great delight by the public. And it still puzzles me, but the short story is that he had a a second act, and American lives are not supposed to have second acts. And he's ridden this acclaim, you know, into the present. He's had other critical moments. The book, the penultimate discussion is just titled Controversies, where we actually go through his most difficult moments. Apart from Tilted Arc, in 1971, a rigger was killed in the installation of one of his pieces. This was in Minneapolis, and Sarah says how traumatic it was for him. And I almost wanted to say, well, what about the other guy? But this also led him to change his work. I mean, these were the work in which the worker rigger was killed was still a prop piece, almost expressly dangerous, although he would never say as much. But it led him to pull the pieces of his sculpture apart. And this led him actually to develop his sculpture into space. And that led him then to push it out into sites, into specific sites, urban and landscape. So it was an important moment, even if this pivot was produced on the body of a dead laborer. There are other controversies. You'll see them as they pop up towards the end. Mm-hmm. What else can I tell you about the book before Colin takes it apart? Sarah is I think he's a very important figure. He's often taken to be a very obnoxious persona. For me, that's manifest in his status as a ferocious interlocutor. He really needs debate. So do I. He had others that he engaged, certainly, as you may have already seen, he was very close to composers like Phil Glass and Steve Reich. He learned a lot from his downtown moment in the 1960s. He was very engaged with Judson Church dance. Even though his persona is very macho, he testifies to how important choreographers like Yvonne Rainer, Tricia Brown, and Simone Forti were to the development of his sculptural language. And if you think about Judson Church and how it's founded in this anti-symbolic move to simple gestures, everyday tasks turned into dance, it's almost impossible to think about the early work of Sarah, in which he writes out a verb list and produces certain actions on certain materials, non-art materials, the way that Judson Church would use non-art props. That was key for him. So, I mean, gender is a problematic area, I think, in the reception of Sarah. And we can talk about that if you want. But he really does own the fact that his most important contemporary artistic inspiration were women. Anyway, so he needs these interlocutors. He certainly had one with Robert Smithson. That was obviously cut short when Smithson died in 1973 at the site of his last earthwork, even though that was also a very conflicted relationship. And Sarah has an extraordinary little psycho-pressy of Smithson that I forgot my book at the hotel, so I can't read it to you. It's worth the price of the book. But this is a person who really needs engagement, and that's very seductive to me. So we are like in some ways. He's 17 years older than I am, you know, and I'm in part formed by the work of his contemporaries and indeed his own work. So we share a language, but we're also quite different. One of the first things that Sarah says in the book is that he grew up in the sand dunes in the Bay Area, in San Francisco. And he said that that location, where, when there were very few houses on the beach there, he grew up a few houses away from Mark DeSouvreau. But that setting, he said, made him self-reliant. And to evoke this, you know, famous phrase or famous word of Emerson, of Ralph Waldo Emerson, is poignant, because self-reliance, there's an American commitment to the transcendentalists, to the pragmatists that informs him. He's also, you know, at base, I think, an existentialist. He's a kid at Berkeley and then at Santa Barbara. He wrote about Camus. This was in the late 1950s. And so he's very concerned with the present of experience, the situation now. And that's key to his sense of aesthetic experience, that it is experience. And that word, in a way, ties Emerson to Camus, to Sarah. And that's very different from my own formation. So you have, in a way, an Emersonian existentialist in conversation with a, you know, wannabe late post-structuralist. I mean, they're just very different worlds. So that actually provides the moments in the conversations that interest me the most, where we simply don't understand each other, or we just glide by each other. And I can talk about some of those moments, if you like. Quickly, you know, when you talk with artists, with writers, some of you know this better than I, when you read about them, they often have stories that they love to tell, origin myths. It helps them narrate a body of work, to make sense of it. Because I think it's actually very important for artists. For writers, it's perhaps easier, but for artists to articulate the project. And Sarah does so with real force. But it was difficult for me at times to get him beyond the stories that I already knew. Because in a way, he relies on them. And they're so good. Let me just tell you quickly a couple of them. And I do get him to move beyond and actually come up with more fictive primal scenes, but they're wild. One is, when he was 3, he says, his father was a pipe fitter in the shipyards in San Francisco. So this was, when would this be? This would be during the war, 1941. His father took him to a launch of a ship, and he was so taken by the sheer mass, the extraordinary weight of this thing. I can't believe he was 3, but again, it's fact, fiction. And he was so struck by the anxiety of this thing, his anxiety as this enormous hulk began to move and to shift and to run down the waves and to crash into the bay and to plummet and then bounce up and to find its balance and to float. And, you know, it's a perfect antidote, because so much of his work, you know, his concerns are there. And he says, oh, this is a dream, a nightmare I've had again and again. Another anecdote he tells that I'd heard before, and it's in the book again. He says, you know, I grew up on the beach, and at a very early age, I walked down the beach and understood the world in one way. You know, just imagine as you would, the landscape as it divides by the shoreline. And then he remembered that he turned, and for the first time, as he walked back, he was struck by how the world was completely different, that these two worlds were sutured together somehow by his body. You know, there was a right-handed world and a left-handed world, and they changed phenomenologically through his movement. But somehow the almost the opacity of his body held them together. And again, he stresses to me in the book how sculpture for him is a body in movement as it experiences an object that activates a sight. I mean, that's in a way how he's opened up the definition of sculpture. The other stories that I get him to tell that are new, maybe made up, he said also as a child, he came upon a pod of beached whales. So in a way, that's the obverse, I suppose, of the ship launch. But this question of how artists, writers, how they tell stories about how they're formed aesthetically, has always interested me. And Sarah has good ones to tell. Let me just say a couple more things, and then give it over to Colin. One of the contradictions that interested me in Sarah, and it's the title of one of the chapters, is that history doesn't go away. He thinks that for an artist, and maybe this is true of writers too, that writing is just available. It's not, nothing, he says at one point, no artist replaces another. Cézanne does not replace Manet, etc. On the other hand, he also insists on a fiercely rivalrous idea of art. In other words, that one competes with immediate predecessors and direct contemporaries. And he actually mentions Harold Bloom. Everything is an agon for Sarah. And he, this is also where his masculinism is in full display. But it's also in a way pathetic because it's so Oedipal. He wants to bring artists back, and he does in these conversations, so that he can kill them again. It's the damnedest thing. It's actually most poignant and most perverse with Donald Judd. He just won't let him go. And one of the chapters is called Down and Dirty Minimalism, and Sarah develops this whole idea of how his cohort of artists, and he somehow works in Warhol here too, but he sees as his cohort, Eva Hess, Bruce Nauman, Robert Smithson, how they rejected the shiny minimalism of Judd and Dan Flavin and Saul LeWitt, that they were much more materialist, that the minimalists still thought about the work of art as an object, even though we like to think that they're the ones who activated space for the first time. Sarah says, no, they just ordered up these products. And it was really we who opened the work of art up to material, to process. So there's a real ag on there, and he said, you know, he dismisses the ready-made, all assemblage is too narrative. Well, that sculpture is crap, too. I was really struck by how he takes down David Smith, because you think this would be a key predecessor for Sarah. But he says, I've never welded in my life. You know, I am the one who brought real industrial procedures into the making of the work, not these bricoleurs. So he's really fierce when it comes to other artists, but also really generous. The only reason I think that Sarah, that we spoke that first night at the Odeon was that he knew that I was friends with some of the pictures artists who had begun to emerge then. And he, you know, even though he saw it as mere pop, you know, and for him it was that work, you know, Cindy Sherman, Louise Lawler, Sherry Levine, Barbara Kruger, it was all image, you know, it was all media. He wanted to take it on. He was very curious about it. And that I think is indicative of how inquisitive he is. It's not just that he's rivalrous. He's also curious in a way that I admire. Just lastly, I'll just point, maybe Colin will too, to some of the issues where we, I think, disagree productively. This is where I hope the book will be of interest to you all as artists and critics and historians, because I think his work initiates or helps to initiate a lot that is still very pertinent now. But he also resists the development of his own work. So we agree and disagree on what has happened, say, to the notion of sight over the 50 years of his life as an artist. Same with the condition of the viewer, of the subject. What really is, can one speak of a subject of the work of art? We disagree about the status of the industrial in a post-industrial world. I mean, basic disagreements. I ask him about his materialism, and it's also quite restricted. I mean, I get him to say that, you know, labor produces the world. But I think his transcendentalist and pragmatist and existential commitments in a way impede his own understanding of how fundamentally Marxist his work is. And we also go back and forth in terms of just the fundamental politics of art. For Sarah, any art that proposes to be political in the first instance misses the point. But, and I come back to this again and again with him, because I don't think that that can be the final word given what his practice is. And we finally get to a place where he somehow is able to reconcile the idea of autonomy and the abstraction that usually is associated with aesthetic autonomy, at least in the last century, to which he's fully committed. He finally gets to the point where he might see this idea as a form of engagement, not really in the manner of Adorno, but somehow the two become less of a contradiction as we talk. And that might be another instance of his existentialism kind of retooled for the present. But maybe I'll stop there.
All right. Thanks. I hope you can hear me in the back if I talk. Yes? No? Can you tell me? Yes. Okay, good. Then I don't have to shout. So... thanks.
Some complaints.
Some complaints. Okay. So how about now? Just give me a thumbs up or something, so I know. I prefer not to stand up if it's okay. How about now? This level, good. Okay. Thanks. Thumbs up. I got a thumbs up. Thanks for being here. And the book is. What can I say? It's like. For me, I realize we're three very different generations.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like everything I thought I had learned in the last 50 or 60 years, much of which is, in a way, confirmed, and much of which is totally surprising and very new in a way. And, of course, the format, I think, is really fascinating as well, in the sense that there's a kind of intimacy to the conversation which allows very strange things to come about.
May I stop you there just to say one anecdote?
Yeah, sure.
In the preface, I said that early on, you know, because these go more than 15 years, they go back almost 30 years, that I, you know, I really was intimidated. And that throughout I'm more a foil. But I had a line in there like, you know, this book might read like Godzilla meets Bambi, which is really how it felt. And Sarah said, well, who's Godzilla? Because I do come on more and more as the conversations move on in time. And when we sent it to a few publishers, and there are a few trade publishers were interested, I just, no, shut up. The hilarious thing was, this is great. We love this book. Is there any way where you could just get rid of your part? Anyway. onward.
I mean, there's so many. I just had some general things that came up, some of which you've already, in a way, talked about. The materialism discussion. You know, where Richard basically says, "I don't understand how any sculpture could be idealist." It's an amazing point, right?
Yeah.
And then when you think about it, turned around, he's right. It's hard to argue against it, right? I mean, it has a concrete material existence in the world. How is it idealist? How is it not in a way materialist? Anyway, I thought.
Can I just flesh that out a little bit?
Yeah.
Am I on too much? Because that wasn't a version of a question. But
it was.
So many points interest me too much.
Yeah.
That's in part, you know, when we talk about Brancusi, for Sarah, Brancusi is a crucial figure. You know, he's one person who he doesn't want to take down. But I say, well, Brancusi is, it's all about the perfection of form. You know, there's an idealist in Brancusi. What do you do with that part?
Right.
And he just refuses to see it. For Sarah, Brancusi is all about material and all about the fact that he, more than anyone, got rid of the pedestal and put sculpture on the floor and grounded it in the world. I mean, that could be debated too. But the other reason why he's so opposed to idealism is that this is his way to undercut conceptualism and minimalism. You know, he says of Saul LeWitt, oh, you know, the idea generates the work. You know, who cares? You know, that's idealist. And he also sees Judd as an idealist, which completely contradicts what Judd had to say. But anyway, back to you.
Yeah, that's right. Anyway, it's. I thought maybe we would talk about a couple of things which I felt like weren't discussed. And you know, for me, a little louder.
Yep.
Yes, back louder.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I thought maybe we'd talk about a couple of things that I felt like, man, I really wanted to hear about that. And you know, for me, and this is why I think the generational thing is very important. The abstraction discussion for me is. It's not as relevant, but there are many times when Richard says that he's concretizing things. And the concrete comes up as a very important thing, and it's one which really resonates when I have, you know, an encounter with his work. And it's so weird that, and I have to say one of the moments in the book which totally threw me was his discussion of this Matisse sculpture as incredibly important, which...
The Serpentine, did it just come by?
Yeah. Which I could not put the two of them together in my mind.
Why?
It's so delicate. It's so right? It's so much about what's not there, the negative space, right? The way in which the figure is carving the spaces, which, you know, it's the sort of anti-move in a way. But this is, that's my own...
But that's actually where he's very open to other kinds of practice.
Absolutely.
The crucial thing about that Matisse sculpture for him is that it transforms figurative sculpture. I mean, the standard for Sarah, and this is where we agree, maybe we're just old avant-gardists, is innovation. We're an artist... enters into a field of practice and is able to turn the language somehow. That for him is absolutely key. And there's a chapter called Prime Objects, which is an idea developed from the art historian George Kubler, about who was a pre-Columbianist. You know, he worked in a field where there were no known authors, and it was about how a tradition is transformed by sometimes by just one object, a prime object, and that otherwise tradition is a sequence of replicas, and that's why he privileges moments that you might not expect.
Yeah, totally.
But that's also, you know, it's a very curvilinear piece, in that he wouldn't have appreciated the Matisse without his turn to his own torqued figures. He says much the same thing about the Etruscan figure that comes up near the Matisse in the slideshow. Anyway.
Yeah, so it got me thinking about the question of light, right? I mean, when you see a torqued ellipse inside, it's very different than when you see it outside, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to think about somebody who's spending all this time putting together a sculptural practice, which is about really being able to account materially for every choice, and that those choices are transparent in the work, I don't know. Maybe it was a side conversation that didn't go anywhere, or maybe it's
about
not.
Light?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that this is a huge issue for me. For example, seeing a recent exhibition in Gagosian versus seeing it right in front of the Philharmonie in Berlin. It's a very different. That's to me, in a way, that's something perhaps one cannot ultimately concretize or pay attention to. But
is that about light or sight or both?
I think it's both. I think the question of sight really doesn't.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're taking all of this into account, right? Then the right. Is it a gray sky? Is it a blue sky?
Right.
It fundamentally changes what he privileges as an experience of the sculpture.
Well, that opens up many things, like the nexus of the gallery versus public or semi or pseudo public space, which we should explore. But you know, one reason why Sarah turns to architecture as a resource, and there are some examples that will come up that are especially important to him, is that he did not find the structural bases in sculpture, in historical sculpture, that he wanted to develop. So he's very interested in sculpture as tectonics. So he really appropriates from architecture, you know, its principle of structure, and reintroduces it to architecture. So that gets him to architecture and why he's taken by certain examples. But when he actually goes to visit different buildings, and this happens throughout his life, but especially as he opens to light in the torque pieces, he visits Ronchamp, the late Le Corbusier, and in France, he goes to the Hagia Sophia, and he understands that in certain buildings, you know, mass and void, light and structure define each other and drive each other. There's an extraordinary image that will come up of Ronchamp that he privileges, in which you see this happen. He says an extraordinary thing occurs when void and mass, light and structure, push each other. They don't they don't somehow draw away from each other, the whole other kind of spatial experience happens. And I think that's in part what led him to go light in a way. I mean, his torque pieces are still enormously heavy, obviously, but they have a lightness, a weightlessness. I mean, it's not simply light in terms of light. It's also weight. And that dynamic has really driven his work. You know, as his pieces became more and more weightless, the very curvy ones, he then returned to an old element of his language, which are these forged pieces, these blocks and rounds, which are all about weight. So I think he's very alert to that tension, and he sees that tension not as a contradiction, but as a way to drive his work forward. Mm-hmm. But it's right, you're right, we don't develop it as much as we should.
Yeah. I mean, you can't talk about everything. Okay, so this is maybe another issue, generational issue. Experience. Mm-hmm. Sends shivers down my spine, right? When I hear it, right? And I think it must be something of my complex. I don't have to say it's generational. It could just be my problem. It probably is just my problem. But it seems to me at the end there's something I still can't resolve between the early work and the work that you go into, right? Where there's this great discussion about Jasper John's reaction to the splashing piece, right? Mm-hmm. Where he says he's just amazed at how all at once it is, right? There's nothing before it, there's nothing after it. It is the action and the thing are the exact same, mm-hmm. right? They're never different. That's hard for me on the question of experience to reconcile with then walking into something and wandering around it. Maybe you guys talked about this, maybe this is something you've thought about as well or not. How is the all-at-once thing that Johns is privileging in the splashing, how does that work then the moment you're peripatetic, right? The moment it's a wandering, right, that happens.
Right. We do talk about it because for me this too was a contradiction. This idea that the work of art must be present all at once—that's a shibboleth of Anglo-American modernist criticism. And this is what Clement Greenberg said about painting. It's what Michael Fried said about painting. The famous line is "presentness is grace." The perfect work, fully resolved, is right there. And it allows you, in the intensity of that experience, almost to transcend that moment. Mm. How can that still be a value for an artist like Sarah, who so stresses time, movement, the body and its experience? But for him, there's no contradiction, that the process creates an effect that is all at once. The splashing pieces. These are forged with enormous difficulty. Pieces that were right there. Yeah. But they appear, when you can begin to unpack the procedure of the making, the production, that the viewer does so or can do so is very important to Sarah. But he feels that the effect, the experience, is still all at once. And that's actually where I disagree. I'm with you. But your own, I'm interested in your own ambivalence, or not even ambivalence, about experience. Yeah. I mean, for my generation, too, this is what we got from the French, right? That, I mean, it was a cliché, but that experience was over, you know, the Vesus, you know.
Right.
Another generation might have had it, but it wasn't for us. And that, you know, that lack was turned into this defiant, oh, it's the end of experience. But this is so crucial to Sarah to insist on it. It might seem archaic, it might seem reactionary, to insist on experience in an ethical register, an aesthetic register, and a political register. He doesn't say it explicitly. He almost does. For him, this is the democratic dimension in that Emersonian line that he wants to claim. And this is actually where we disagreed. You know, I would be more on the side, your side, in terms of experience, but also on the side of subjectivity. You know, I say to him again and again, you know, I understand that, you know, your emphasis and the emphasis of your generation on phenomenology, on the concrete, that's so distinctive. And it has to be seen, I think, as resistance to pop, resistance to a society of spectacles. Sarah still hates any art to do with image, with narrative. I mean, the gestalt, the picture are taboo for him. So it's mostly reactive. But he insists on experience because it not only for its own intensity, but because it can be shared. Mm. And, you know, for a person of my generation, and I think also for you, this idea that there's one subject of experience was deeply problematic. And, you know, I early on, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, this was my the main point in my critique of minimalism, that this opening to phenomenology presumes a life that we have in common. And clearly that's not the case, that we're divided and structured and divided by all kinds of differences. And so much of the work that has come out of this generation has articulated these differences in subject position. I mean, that too is a cliche. But I was really impressed by how Sarah and his wife, who's his chief interlocutor, Clara Weiergraf, how they insist that the work is open to any subject of experience and that it's in the experience that the subject is differentiated. That the work does not make that differentiation for the viewers. Mm. And in this way, it would be at antipodes from feminist work like Barbara Kruger, who, you know, address you or a we or a they and specify different subject positions. For Sarah, that's a fundamentally, even though he admires Barbara Kruger enormously because she brought in advertising into work and into art in a new way, and that innovation is, you know, his primary criterion. He thinks that subject differentiation actually divides audiences and splits up reception. And that's actually one point where he's so at odds with, you know, people like you and me.
Yeah. But where do you think that exists then? I mean, this space between, I mean, there must be a way to draw a line between Kruger and Sarah, or other artists. I mean, it seems to me the point maybe I'm kind of clumsily making about the trying to reconcile these two very different bodies of work is that in the all at onceness that he talks about with John's, the very question of one's encounter with something is already thought about. Whereas when one goes into the to the larger pieces, right, to the torqued ellipses or mm-hmm. whatever it is, that very thing, the differentiation of the subject, it can't be thought about, right?
Well, again, he would argue that's makes the work open to all, and that one, you know, anybody can experience my work. But in the experience, that body differentiates its own experience, that he does not program it. And, you know, I'm not here to convince you, but I just want to make clear what his position is, because it pushes back, I think, in a salutary way on our automatic celebration of difference.
Yeah, that's sure.
It's very similar to me, the argument that we have about sight, because, you know, part of my story about post-war art is the complication of this concept. You know, if Sarah pushes sculpture out into space and then into sight, and for him that first piece, that plate of steel stuck in the corner called Strike, that's a prime object for him because it's the first piece that really declares, this is how he puts it, declares the space, you know, commands it somehow. That got him to think about this redefinition of sculpture as a body in space, a particular space in time and movement. For him, that remains the fundamental idea of sight. But as most of you know, that the articulation of sight has gone on to many different iterations. I mean, sight then became not just physical, but institutional. You know, it became gallery-museum nexus, and that was investigated. Then it became discursive. I mean, there were concepts that were sight. One could do a project about queer desire or homelessness or, you know, there's a whole articulation of the subject vis-a-vis art and of sight vis-a-vis art that Sarah understands. You know, he has a relationship to that history, but he refuses it, he resists it. And again, I test him, and for me this is a real art historical conundrum. I test him with ideas that his work in a way prompted in part, questions that his work prompted, and he refused them. And so I just ask all of you, can an artist or can anyone ask of an artist, of a writer, can they be tested in terms of ideas, terms, concepts that their own work opens up but does not follow? See what I mean? Can you round on them historically, or do you have to see them in the context of their own production all the time? You know, that there are a couple moments when the conversation just grinds to a halt, and this is when I make that claim. Like, but in a way, it's good because it shows our own blind spots to each other. And he says, you know, how can you judge me on a bar that's developed past my own day in court, you know? I said, this is what art historians do.
Right.
We don't always historicize. And we just like, there it's more like, you know, the Sidon headbutt where he just takes me out. It's not so much Godzilla meets Bambi, but he gets the red card as far as I'm concerned, or the black card.
What do you think the... we could probably just generalize and say this is a question of death and one's career, and it's maybe not specific to Sarah in a way. But what is it? I mean, he's somebody who works, at least in the beginning, I'm still stuck on this contradiction between the early and the later stuff. As soon as you walk into something, it's not all at once. So it's hard. It's really hard for me anyway, but we don't have to talk about my complexes. On the one hand, you see the splashing pieces and you think this is somebody who has managed to solve the kind of temporal riddle of sculpture by the making and the forging, and everything is happening. It's all there. It's immediate. There's no hidden studio process. It's there. It's an action.
And that transparency is crucial to him.
And the transparency. Yeah. But then he talks very much like somebody who's making things to outlive all of this, right? To kind of contribute in a way to... And yet, at the same time, still stuck with his own kind of mortality in a way, right? I mean, I think that's...
Colin, don't you think... I mean, this this happens to artists.
I do.
They begin, you know, the the intervention is to explode the criteria. I mean, that's the drive. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Judd did the same thing. He said, you know, why should I be interested in quality? That's a value judgment that refers to the past. His famous line is, a work of art needs only to be interesting. So it's all about the moment of experience again. And the work might not last at all. And to his credit, Sarah says at one point, who knows how long I will have, anyone has, as an artist. You know, Duchamp said 30 years, he's had more. Warhol said 15 minutes, he's had more. You don't know. And I actually think he says, too, that it's not clear that his work will have much of a future. I mean, it will as his work, but in terms of another crucial criterion of value, you know, how fertile, how fecund, how productive is it for other artists? It's not clear to me that it is. Mm. It's not clear to him. But what I wanted to say about, you know, there is a move to the monumental in his work, and it's qualified a little bit by this lightness that returns, this weightlessness that returns in the Torque pieces. But
and he hates that word.
He hates it, right, because he was beaten up with it with Tilted Arc. Mm. It was seen as, you know, the worst kind of, this is a temporary piece, extraordinary piece, but pieces like this that lasted on site were seen as the worst monument. So he's very ambivalent, but as his work has moved on, he turns 80 next week, he's very aware, and this is actually a question I have for all of you, of his own late style. I mean, can an artist, can a writer be aware of such a thing? I mean, was Beethoven in the late quartets? I mean, I suppose he was. Did he know when he would die? You know, was Yeats aware? I think maybe he was aware in his late poetry of a new asperity. It doesn't always have to be austere. I mean, we talk about how Matisse in his late style, you know, opened up to a new delight. And I think there's actually both in late Sarah. A real return to weight and a real return to light. But he is conscious of a new monumentality, and it is part of a late style, and it has everything to do with his own mortality, with mortality as such. And this is where we get to maybe the trickiest point in the conversation, where we talk about symbolic forms and the way that recent work and this, we'll see some in a while, are not only weighty, but almost ceremonial. He's done recent pieces that look like stelae or sarcophagi that have everything to do with death, and he owns up to it. I mean, this might seem as another, you know, masculinist moment where he makes a grand statement about his own mortality, but his work, you know, obviously one knows the Sarah when one sees it, but it's also not bound up, for me anyway, with the personality. That's maybe a thing we can debate, but I began to ramble, sorry.
No, but the monumentality question kind of goes away without really figuring out at the end if it is a monument, and let's say in a way it does monumentalize something, right? What does it monumentalize?
Because we come up with the phrase monumentality without monuments, and he likes this idea. He's interested in monuments once the iconographic significance, the social importance, are lost to them. Right. I mean, he's interested in what persists, and this this is a different register of time that has entered his work. The presentness of the work all at once, not the temporality of what it is to walk around in a Torque ellipses, but, you know, contemporary philosophers speak about it as ancestral time. What happens to work to art when not only the artists, the society, sometimes even the history is stripped away, what remains to it?
Yes.
And that also might be seen as a grandiose fantasy, but he's very interested in that dimension of time too. And that has to do with this new monumentality. This is another origin story, late, where he goes into the San Carlo church, quite small church by Borromini in Rome, and there's an ellipse on the floor, an ellipse on the ceiling, and he enters on the side. This is how he tells the story. And he thinks somehow that they're twisted in relation to him, and that he's encountered a volume that is quite literally torqued. And that, for him, is a way to explain the inspiration for all his torqued position pieces. That's kind of a misrecognition about a piece of architecture. Anyway.
But the architecture question is the one I was kind of hinting at with the monumentality, right? I mean, I think, there is a... Can one monumentalize a lack or an absence or a homelessness, right? I mean, I just think of the Paul Valéry quote about about museums, right? You know, there are... and the abandoned children painting and sculpture, right? Well, this is... I mean, what it seems to me, if there is a kind of significance to the experience created, right, and these things, and let's say it's an if, but one has to experience it, and if one has that, I've had that mm-hmm. experience. You've had that experience for sure.
Well,
why does it work?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it doesn't. Well, I mean, there are sort of. General.
Why does the sculpture seem to have an effect in this condition?
Yes. Why?
Yeah. One way into the monument question that we take up, because I make a run at it a few times. You know, I rehearse the famous account of Rosalind Krauss that, you know, modern sculpture is born when the monument fails. You know, when there's no longer a socius that shares a history that can be commemorated. You know, for Krauss, you know, Rodin, you know, his problems with commissioned sculpture is the exemplum of this crisis. And in her argument, this is where modern sculpture begins to draw into its own forms. It becomes abstract, sightless, you know, in a way... fails the public or refuses the public. Sarah, in a way, and this goes back to this question of how he turns autonomy back into engagement, he returns abstraction into the world. I mean, quite literally, he puts these arcs, these ellipses, these spirals back into space. And then we should talk maybe about the kinds of spaces and what allows this return to happen. But I think that's really important. But they still attest, because he refuses image, he refuses narrative, they still attest to a lack of a public. And all of his difficulties, even though he's committed to as public a work as he can make, or he can, you know, can be supported, they almost always fail. They're, in the sense that they're, well, Tilda Arc was attacked and destroyed. They're often graffitied. Other artists, David Hammons, famously did work in relation to some where he peed on one, he threw tennis shoes over, actually the same sculpture. You know, he claimed it, and I can talk to you about why he did so. But yeah, they're failures, actually, as public monuments.
Yeah.
So, but I think... This might seem like a stretch, but I make the case in the book that precisely because these public pieces produce so much conflict, that too is a democratic condition, because they point to that, you know, absence in a democracy of a core. I mean, at the core of democracy is conflict, is agon. You know,
yeah.
I mean, this is Laclau and Mouffe 101, but, you know, Sarah doesn't know that not interested in that kind of political philosophy. At one point, he says to me, "Fuck you." He didn't say that. He did in the tape. "Fuck you. I'm not a political philosopher." And this is just when I make that case about how his work doesn't produce conflict; it exposes conflict that exists, and that conflict is around a lack of, you know, of a common.
Yeah. So would you? Maybe we should take some questions, but just to push you on my final my final reading about this, would you say that even in their scale, right, even in their sort of massive, right, some of these public works, that they are in a way kind of elegies for, in that sense, monumental, right, because they mourn in a way the exactly that kind of condition? I mean, do you think, mm-hmm. I mean, and this is... maybe a different question for Rosalind Krauss about this. I don't think you can ever really get rid of that part, right?
That's what part?
That part of sculpture, the monumentality. I don't think it's not, right? I mean, it's like getting rid of a symptom in psychoanalysis. It doesn't go away, right? It's just worked on. And I wonder,
yeah.
Even in their scale, the sort of massiveness, right? And the relationship to architecture in particular, that it isn't in a way, I mean, it's not surprising that he gets commissions to do things at the Holocaust Museum, right? I mean, there is a, right, and we can talk about Berlin, which we didn't,
yeah.
Weirdly enough, the commission here, right, as well, right? There, as much as we're talking about the kind of general E experience, we never, right? I mean,
right.
I think that part of it is
there. That's actually one controversy that Memorial with Peter Eisenman. We do take up, and it, I think it's a telling one in terms of the relationship between artists and architects. I mean, that's a subject we haven't broached. Maybe we can in discussion. But Sarah says it boils down to the joke about a chicken and a pig. They see a sign, it says ham and eggs. 25 cents. And the chicken says, "That looks like a good deal." And the pig says, "Maybe for you, all you have to do is lay an egg. I lose my ass." So that's his parable of artist, architect, collaboration. And I think he experienced it in Berlin.
Yeah.
But the, you know, if they monumentalize anything, you know what I think they monumentalize? They monumentalize this moment of the pastness of an industrial age.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of the appeal. They emerge in this second life in the 1990s, 2000s, in a fully post-industrial moment where post-industrial, I mean, obviously there's industry still, but post-industrial procedures have worked all the way through industrial fabrication. And I think part of the appeal of these sculptures is that we can think about the industrial almost romantically now.
Mm.
That in the industrial age, you know, the artisanal aspect of art was appreciated because of its outmoded quality. In a way, the industrial has entered that charm of the outmoded. I mean, maybe it's hard to buy such a line. So many of these pieces seem so aggressive, but I think that's, if there's a monumentality there, it's their monuments to an industrial revolution that has somehow passed many times over. And, you know, I get Sarah to admit as much, and I think for all his interest in the artist as avant-gardist, he sees his work as the end of a period, not the beginning of one. He doesn't think that it will be developed much. And part of that industrial, post-industrial pathos is that he's an artist fully embraced by neoliberal plutocrats, and why would that be so? And that, too, is a moment where the conversation grinds to a halt, where I say as much and we attempt to process it. But
maybe,
yeah. Can I, maybe, if anybody wants to leave, maybe that would be a moment now just to take a break.
Everybody can go.
And then I think there's room for 2-3 people up here, maybe. If anybody wants to try and come up here, I don't know. Yeah, should we do that?
Yeah.
Okay. Can we also leave the door open, please? I don't know if we'll get ventilation in here. It's difficult. We could open that, maybe. Yeah? Can we try?
Is it open?
We haven't opened this since we painted it.
Let's open.
Thank you. So, questions,
comments, attacks.
Yeah. Did you discuss boxing?
Well, actually, one of the first trade editors said he was very taken by the fact that Sarah was an athlete. He went to Berkeley to play football, American football, but he actually broke his back, and that's actually when he got into art. I mean, he was always interested in drawing as a kid. But and this editor, this publisher said to me, that's what you need to develop. More stuff like that. I mean, get him to talk about his football days. It's like, why boxing?
Because you've been using phrases like, or pictures of geometry and weight and American macho-ness and big squares where things happen and the conflict between floats like a butterfly, stings like a bee, all of those things. People,
right.
I keep hearing those in what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, and that first photograph, the Robert Frank photograph of Sarah, it's you know, like a boxer in a steel ring. He has that attitude. He is very pugilistic, and he sees everything as a match, really. But you know, for me, there's just not enough of that agon in contemporary art, contemporary culture. Sarah came out of a moment when the art world was very small, and the discussions were limited but intense. And in a way, too often in a very expanded art world, we've allowed conflict to dissipate, I think. So I don't like the macho aspect of the boxing analogy, but I like the discursive one. Yeah, he won. But not always. I mean, I say, in my preface, I turn to, you know, sport in the sense that it did seem like fencing with him as opposed to boxing. But yeah, I mean, the whole, for all his celebration of contemporary artists who were women, gender is obviously a problematic area for Sarah and others of his generation.
Other, Ms. Joanna?
I'll stand up. I'd like to ask about this notion of experience that you mentioned also in your review and Sarah in relation to titled art, because he says the work should be open, it's ultimately about bodies in the space, and at the end the work was removed, I guess, from the public, right? So the public acted in order to remove the work. So how would you and how would he see the notion of the experience? Would the removal also be part of the experiencing of the artwork? And how do you see it in relation to what was talking about participation in art?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, one that we do not take up. It was difficult enough to get him to talk about the controversies in his career. Yeah, I mean, I think it could be argued that Tilda d'Arc is one of those works that's famous for its disappearance more than for its appearance. I mean, it's true of the Fountain of Duchamp. It's never exhibited. It never appeared, but it's a crucial piece in the history of modern art, obviously. Tilda d'Arc might be like that. Its importance is in the public debate and the governmental destruction. And it's in a parking lot somewhere in New Jersey.
Upstate New York.
But as we all know, that literally is nowhere. Well, upstate New York is, but New Jersey is a New Jerseyan.
It used to be. Maybe it's moved.
But for him, it's finished. But it is an example of... that was the difficulty of the controversy and the difficulty of the hearings. They were twisted as they were framed because it was, in a way, engineered by the government that commissioned the piece, the hearings were. So we all knew, or we all had a good idea how it would turn out, and certainly the lawyers did. But it was a case in which the experience of some people was pitted against the experience of others. So people like me testified on behalf of the extraordinary experience in the moment of what it is to, you know, look down this arc and have the plaza be defined as a space and how important it was phenomenologically. And others said, well, no, I want to have my lunch here and I don't want to be walled out. But it was also crazy. And we go into this. People said, oh, you know, it's... I mean, this is where the attack on public art really ramps up in the Reagan years. Security people in the building said it's created a rat problem. This is in the early days of bombings. There was one security professional who came in to say this was a perfect form to augment a bomb blast. It was actually quite paranoid how the public was positioned. But there were people who just wanted to have a different experience of the plaza. And it was impossible not to say, you're right, you know, it's your experience too. But this is where I go back to conflict as somehow democratic in its responses. You know, Sarah didn't buy it for a second.
Your testimony.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would it be horrible to ask you, Sam, what you think about this? Well, is Sam Durant, a very important American artist, sculptor, who's also had experience with such conflict recently.
Yeah, I mean, the tilted arc, you know, looking back at that has been really interesting and important for me, thinking about what happened with Scaffold.
Does everyone know the Scaffold story? Can you say a little bit?
You can look it up online.
Okay.
let's stick to Sarah, because actually I'm really curious. But for me, that piece was so powerful because it made you aware of the space you were in, the shitty job you had to go to in the shitty government building, and the crappy lunch you were eating, and the advertising images all over the space that were, of course, ignored. And all of the, you know, my take is all of our discontent with the everyday repressive environment that we live in, rather than change the conditions that we live and work in. Like, why do we have to look at advertising all the time, for instance? Those were all focused onto the Sarah sculpture.
Hmm.
And so it becomes a kind of an easy target for people's aggression. And you mentioned Agon.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what happened. You know, one of my theories is what happened is that the folks in the government building that didn't want the sculpture there were very clever at focusing people's aggression onto the sculpture to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of manipulation to get rid of the sculpture of people's already existing discontent with the repressive reality. And, you know,
Do you think there's any way for an artist to deflect or inflect that discontent in ways that he or she would not become the object of it?
Well,
use it creatively?
Well, Mitchell's piece that he wrote about the Tilted Arc shortly afterwards. It's an interesting piece. It was written in the late 80s. But his basic take is like all public art is either violence itself, inflicting a violence on the public, which is what many of the people were claiming, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sarah's sculpture is literally oppressing me. It's violence towards me. Or it is going to provoke people to violence over its symbolic meaning.
Mm-hmm.
So Mitchell's very pessimistic about public art, monuments, etc., period. And then the second half of his essay is about Spike Lee's film, Do the Right Thing, which is also interesting.
Hmm.
But I forget the question you were asking. No, artists cannot. At a certain point, there's certain moments when artists cannot do anything. There are these moments when all these forces come into play in a kind of perfect storm, and there's nothing you can really do about it. It's only, you know, you just choose your reaction. I think Sarah's reaction was, you know, what one would expect.
What did Sarah want you to say at that point in time? There's that book of his testimonies, and I remember reading yours, but what would the ideal Bambi have said?
I think Bambi would have, or the mother would have, I don't know. I think he, you know, I ask him, you know, did the world divide into two for you at this moment for the sculpture and against the sculpture? And he says, no, but it did. And I didn't support it as passionately enough because I wanted to get at the conflictual aspect. I didn't want to, deny the experience of
conflict.
Yeah, the problem was that the opponents used the conflict to pit these two groups against each other, and you saw it happen, and you felt helpless before it. But let me just ask you quickly one question: do you feel that your piece Scaffold is now known for what has happened to it, and that how do you feel about that outcome?
Maybe we should say what Scaffold is about.
Yeah,
I made a sculpture called Scaffold, which was a compilation of all these different historical gallows, and it was exhibited first in Documenta 13. It was then bought by the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where it was constructed last year. And just before it was set to be open, in the public sculpture garden, I don't think they have a Richard Serra actually there. Anyway, it was protested by a group of Dakota Indians because it included a scaffold that was used to execute 38 Dakota Indians in the 1860s, during the beginnings of what we call the Indian Wars, the territorial expansion in the U.S. And they objected to me as a white artist including that representation in the sculpture in a sense in their hometown, in their region, in, on their land, basically. And then there was quite a huge social media controversy, and it became a big story. There was a lot of misinformation because of social media, I think. And I don't know. I guess I feel like it's going to take time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe in the way, you know, Tilted Arc has. I don't know, gained meaning with
mm-hmm.
time,
mm-hmm.
or think about it in a more nuanced way.
Mm-hmm. But that becomes part of its significance. And
it does,
that,
yeah.
I mean, you're not alone there. I mean, it's not just you and Tilted Arc. It's, there are many examples over time, and often they're the most important ones, because what they expose about particular period.
Anyway. But I don't mean to dominate
yeah.
the questions, but I just wanted, I wondered what you thought, and this is maybe conjecture, what might have happened had Tilted Arc not been protested and taken down? If it had opened or had kept open a direction that Sarah could have gone in.
Well, he would say, and he did say, that it didn't deflect his work at all.
Mm.
And for him, and he says again and again that form and structure is all important. And for him, the piece, in a way like this piece, is all about what it opened up for him. The reason why he said to destroy the work, to move the work is to destroy it in relation to Tilted Arc, is that most people think that it's just a section of a cylinder set on a plaza, in which case it could be moved. Like, St. John's Rotary Arc, which is a work they did about the same time right outside the Holland Tunnel. That is just a convexity that could be moved because it just sits on the field. Tilted Arc is actually... Sarah says it's impaled, it's embedded in its site, because it rises to the level of the plaza at its center, but it's actually not simply a section. It's a real curvature. It's in, and for him, that's the first time in which maybe not the first time, but in an urban setting where it was cited as an embedded. And that became really important to him in terms of works that were not temporary. So that it was a formal structural change that he then elaborated in all his site-specific pieces. But we do, he too talks about aggression. And he also mentions advertising and graffiti and what can one do in public space to act out against its oppressive nature. It's an important question for him.
Question two things. I think one of the pictures, the slab for the door, it says it's Gelsenkirchen, it's actually Essen. It's just the location is wrong, but that doesn't matter. But the actual question is...
Which one?
The slab for the door, Schönenbach.
Yeah.
It says
right.
Gelsenkirchen.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually in Essen.
That's
another city. That one. It's close to the Emscher Park, but it's not in.
So much for site specificity. I mean, these are captions from Sarah.
That's why we have the book. I didn't want to break it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, they're a little, as with every any book, you. The only
yeah.
thing you see are the little errors. Thank
yeah.
you.
The actual question is, when you were talking about monumentalizing a gap, I immediately had to think about the Holocaust Memorial. Uh-huh. And I didn't know that Richard Serra was involved in the project. So I had to look it up on the phone when you said it.
Yeah.
But there obviously is something in the Holocaust Memorial
that
reminded me so much of it,
yeah.
of him and what he said. So for me the question is, could you say more about why did he remove himself from the project and mm-hmm. how does he look back at it today?
Right. Yeah, that's taken up in the conversation about controversies, also in relation to the chicken and the pig. Although he does not harbor any real animosity for Eisenman, as he feels that Eisenman, as an architect, was in a different position where he never claimed any autonomy, but as an artist, Serra wanted to protect his autonomy. What he says, in effect, is that the language very much is his, much more than Eisenman. And the way that his language is taken up in memorials and monuments, I mean, the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C. by Maya Lin is clearly influenced by Serra. And he's interested in that elaboration. He's not concerned to take it up on his own, but he's interested in how that has happened. But what happened with his involvement in the memorial here is that, it's a great anecdote, really. He says that Helmut Kohl came into the office that Eisenman had set up and said, you have to make it smaller, and actually took out a red pen and began to hack away at it. And Serra says, and this is, again, pugilistic, if not macho, he said to Cole, well, this happened to me in Washington, D.C., too. He was supposed to do a big piece at the end of Pennsylvania Avenue, and he got into a complication with Venturi. This was actually under Carter, not even Reagan. And he backed away. So he explained to Cole that this is... it happened to him before, and he didn't want it to happen again, and that's when he pulled out.
At the Finnish memorial, is there any, does he comment on the final product, so to speak?
He says, and I don't believe it, but I didn't push him on it. He says he's never seen it. Which, so that's his comment.
Question there?
Yes. I have a question also regarding generation stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this work, sometimes it became like very popular in Instagram because of the monumental scale.
It became popular where?
Instagram.
Yeah.
Like, in taking photos of it. So you think that is like a new expansion of monumental art, like it's another way of monumental art, or
to appear as images everywhere?
Yeah,
yeah.
Or in the other way, it reveals and loses like the experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, again, his first point of opposition is to image, because he thinks that the image takes away from our body, which is the substrate of any experience. It's a very emphatic position, a very reductive position. So, again, his dismissal of so much art is that it's just media, it's just pop. But he does feel that the people who come to his work most openly are young people. And that's why we have a few images of kids in the sculpture, that they play in the sculpture, they surf the sculpture. I mean, for a while he was very offended that kids would attempt to run up the sides of the torque pieces. I said, Richard, this is great. you want experience, this is what they have. They have a virtual physical relation to these new spaces that you've opened up. But he's still resistant to the image. And this, we haven't really talked about it, but this is one point that I think is very important, almost beyond his work, which is his implication in the, you know, what I call the art-architecture complex, because there's a way in which his work, you know, his generation, you know, moved beyond the gallery and scale, and that was to test the limits of the salon experience of art, of the gallery experience, of the museum experience. But there's a way in which it was recaptured by museums that were developed out of retooled factories, you know, ex-industrial sites, you know, to contain that expansion of scale. So he's involved in a maybe in a boxing match with architects, you know, this and for me, that development in architecture is really often about the development not only of a huge sculptural object, but also of a huge media image. You know, think about the Bilbao effect. You know, Frank Gehry is bound up with Richard Serra and this kind of development of an architectural language in relation to a sculptural language, and sometimes literally so. And what's happened with the development of the architecture is that becomes then a very attractive icon or logo for a city or a region as it actually retools from an industrial basis to a post-industrial one of service or tourism. Is Serra implicated in that development? I think to an extent he is. His work can also be seen as iconic. I mean, he's done some projects that come up here in Qatar that I think are really problematic as monuments and as icons for a regime. And there too we have, you know, moments of fierce disagreement.
Two more questions maybe here, there. Three questions, there's one in the back as well. Yes?
In the very beginning, when you started introducing the project, you, I think if I understood correctly, characterized Serra as a Marxist. I was curious whether you could elaborate on that, because in a way I would understand it to mean a focus on how these objects or artifacts mediate social relations, and then everything else you've said, and also the little I know about Serra sounds like almost the opposite. I mean, this emphasis on a kind of undifferentiated experience as opposed to looking at, for example, the laborer who got killed. Or, I mean, yeah, so I was curious where you locate that.
Well, I want to claim that there are aspects of the work that could be seen as Marxist. He's not, although we end the book with a discussion of contradictions. And the first thing he says is Clara, his wife, when they first got together, said to him, "You must work through your contradictions." And that's his mantra in the studio. And I think outside of a Marxist formation, that's a basic Marxist concept, that one develops new positions through contradiction. And I take your point about social relations, but what is actually fundamental, at least in his view, to his formation is his experience as a 15-year-old catching rivets and setting trusses in factories in the Bay Area. He's a working class kid, and he understood certain industrial procedures and how they could be developed in an art practice. And he does think that labor produces the world. And I ask him, you know, what is your relationship to the working class now? And that's in part what the steelwork film is about. And this is actually where he and Clara, who is a Marxist, came together. They make the first thing that they do together is make this film about the forging of the Charlie Chaplin piece outside the Neue National Gallery, and about the opacity of the labor for the workers who make the piece. That they they interview the workers, they say they don't understand the piece, it has no relationship to what they do as people, let alone as laborers. So that was to point out that that his commitment to industrial procedures might be rhetorical, that it wasn't a way to connect with the working class at all. But there is a constructivist dimension that runs through his work, which is that about the absolute necessity of the transparency of materials, of making, of receiving, viewing, if possible, too. And that's a fundamental Marxist position, that you must de-fetishize the work of art. This is where we get into the real problem of his relation in the neoliberal economy. You know, I ask him, what is your relation to the working class now? It's, ethically, politically, I still feel a connection, but it's not my world anymore. For Sarah, the work is everything, and he scotomizes. He is blind to the economy that supports it. That's the fundamental contradiction that he does not work out in his practice. He does so only to the extent that he's committed to work when he can to put pieces in public spaces. He will do it for free. But it's a great question for him that we develop, but maybe not enough in the conversation.
There's that very touching scene where he talks about as a young man working in a factory and going on the weekend to see the building that his little rivets are part of, right? And
yeah, the Crown Cellarback building in
San
Francisco. Yeah.
And the pride that he feels going there on the weekends just to see this building going up, and he's made some tiny rivets that are going to go into this building. I don't know.
And he also, you know, he feels this way in relation to the rigors that make his work, but Clara then intervenes as says there, you know, that's an egalitarian situation. It's not at all life in a factory or life in an office. But he also says of that building as it went up that it was also modern. You know, it was really important to him that he identified with his little piece of its making as a modern building.
There's a question there and a question there.
You elaborated on his aversion to image, to narrative, and how does he reconcile it with his intense involvement in the memorials that, as the object is presented, it's immediately injected with narrative, with iconography?
Another great question. I do ask him as well. This is where he begins to talk about his interest in monuments when the imagistic, symbolic, iconographic dimension is stripped away. So I think, and I got him to admit it, that image does return in his work, but it returns at the level of symbolic form, not as a symbol on a surface, but as a intuitive experience of a form like a grave. We talk about this great moment, Adolf Loos, great Austrian architect, a century ago, says in terms of his primacy and his origin myth of architecture, you know, one is in a wood, and you come into an opening, clearing, and you see a mound, and you understand that it's not a natural thing, and it dawns on you that it's a grave. And he says, that is architecture. I think Sarah would say, why not say that is sculpture? He's interested in these primal connections to human creations. And they tend to be funereal, especially in his late style, when the work summons up a stele or a sarcophagus. So it's at that level of the symbolic that he's interested in. He says, you know, at one point to me, you're the one who, you know, who doesn't believe in these symbols. I say, well, it's, you know, the collective unconscious is a scary concept. It's usually racial. And he says, well, you don't have to be a Christian to be affected by a church. I mean, that's how he thinks about the level of the symbolic that interests him. Again, it's an idea of the human that cuts under differences. And, it, you know, many of us might see it as problematic, but he affirms it.
Why would you call it symbolic and not universal? I mean, when you, let's say, Cassirer's symbolic form, that's a thing that is about something which only a particular culture recognizes, right? But the mound thing in the... And the specter of death, that doesn't sound like a symbol anymore in that sense, right? It sounds almost universal in a way.
Well, it's more formal than symbolic, scary. But I agree, but I wonder what costs we simply deny that there are such intuitions. God knows there is a certain turn away from difference in our day. I mean, there's a, you know, I never, as a devout anti-humanist, I never thought I would live to see the day that the human has returned. And, you know, maybe problematic for us, but, you know, maybe that's a dimension of the aesthetic that our combined generations, dismissed too readily. I don't know.
Question there?
Yeah, this is something of a throwaway question. It's brought up in the department, so I'll throw it away. Has everybody made a comment recently about the maybe inadvertent visual line between east-west, west-east, and these Trump wall segments down by Tijuana?
Yeah. Damn, that's a question I really wish I'd asked. there it would have turned into boxing. This was very effective vis-a-vis Tilted Arc, and it's still very effective. I mean, I've helped him cite a piece at my university. This is years ago now. But the thing that most enrages him is when his work is called a wall. That would blow his mind, but why not? I mean, these convergences have to be explored, I think. And obviously this is a period of very nasty convergences of right and left and politics and culture, and maybe you should have a conversation with him and publish it online, and you can ask him. Part two.
Yeah, put on your fencing mask.
Yeah, right.
Very good. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All of you. Thank you.